It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, if you have to choose between, say, buying a new car or taking a trip, you should take the trip. And we're going to tell you why.
First, an investigative report this week shows Wisconsin is lagging behind in making certain kinds of crime data available to the public.
The most recent crime data available from the Department of Justice is from 2012, which lags behind many other states and even the federal government.
Keegan Kyle joins us now. He worked on the report as an investigative reporter for the USA Today Network in Wisconsin. Keegan, welcome back to the studio.
Thank you very much.
Well, first, let's talk about what kind of data we're talking about. I'm assuming the Department of Justice has a lot of different stuff they put out. What are they behind on?
There are three kind of main categories of data that they collect and regularly publish on a website. There's kind of the crime data, so how many crimes are happening in your community. There's data on crime solving, so how many crimes are police actually solving. And then there's also this data on how many arrests they make that is much more detailed down to, like, even curfew arrests for, like, youth in the streets.
And what would people use this for? This could be something that you could go online and say, what's been happening in my neighborhood or what's going on in the neighborhood I might want to buy a house in or rent an apartment in.
Exactly. I mean, that's the common use that we use for crime statistics for, is to look at cities to think about, you know, that we might be moving to or where we want to put our kids in good school districts. All of that commonly used data is normally published on this website for people to kind of look at and compare one city to another.
This might be a public accountability measure, too. I see lots of crime here, not many crimes, not many arrests made. What's going on? The public might use that in that way, too.
Exactly. Particularly with, like, the crime-solving statistics and the arrest statistics, those are much more metrics of kind of what police are doing to keep you safe than necessarily crime stats. I mean, crime stats are one metric of how safe we are, but arrests and crime-solving stats are another way to kind of look at what police are actually doing about it.
So where is the Department of Justice on this now? How far behind are they?
They have published 2012 data. 2014 is the data that is published in Minnesota, Michigan, Illinois, the federal government, many other states.
So why? Why has this fallen behind?
Well, Attorney General Brad Schimel came in about a year ago and looked at this outdated website and said he wanted to update it. And for about the past year, they've been kind of looking for some new software that they can release this data publicly. And just recently did they finally find that software to put it online.
And so the Department of Justice isn't denying that this is behind. They know this is a known problem for them.
Oh, yeah. It was. I first talked to them about it last summer. They were working on this very actively, kind of looking for how can we fix this to get data to people more easily.
Talking to Keegan Kyle about his reporting for the USA Today Network here in Wisconsin on crime data, the state falling behind on information made public on a state website. Now, you came across this as a part of another investigation that we've talked to you about, untested rape kits in Wisconsin. And so how did you encounter this backlog?
Exactly. You remember back then the state had released a survey of untested rape kits across the state, and there are hundreds of untested kits that are just sitting in evidence rooms across the state. And we wanted to try to look at, is there some correlation to agencies that have a lot of untested kits versus, you know, how often they actually solve rape crimes? You know, that's an example of what this data would be really good for. But when we went to the website, we ended up at this wall, which is there is no data after 2012. And when we went to the department and requested more recent data, that's when we started having this conversation about, well, we've been continuing to collect this data, but it's not really available until we can kind of modernize our system for publicly releasing it.
So where are they on that? Is there an ETA on when they're going to get that new software up and running and have this data, more up-to-date data, available for the public?
Right. The Department of Justice plans it'll be updated within the first quarter of the year. So we're looking at the next 3 months, you know, finally getting our data on 2013 and hopefully even more recent than that.
So this is an important tool for not just the public, but obviously for reporters, too. How important is it for the media to have this kind of information to be able to do reports like the ones you do?
Yeah, it's particularly important when it comes to monitoring the activities of law enforcement. It's pretty common, I think, for police agencies to publicly produce their crime statistics, to bring those up and discuss those at community meetings, at city council meetings. But arrest statistics and crime-solving statistics are a lot less common to be talked about, and those are the ones that sometimes can be much more revealing about what tactics they're using to, you know, really fight different types of crimes in the community. And I've done quite a bit of analysis of that in the past, and sometimes these databases will reveal to police agencies and the public tactics that the police agencies themselves don't fully kind of understand. You know, it's only when you're looking in this much broader sense of one police agency compared to another can you get a better sense of, wow, this tactic is really unique, or this is following a trend of what people are doing to fight crime.
So having up-to-date info could be useful for police departments themselves.
Exactly. You know, crime statistics are still one of the major ways that law enforcement agencies use to evaluate their effectiveness of the tactics that they're using, both crime levels as well as arrests and crime-solving numbers. So the fact that the public doesn't have access to anything since 2012 limits our ability to kind of do a similar analysis of, is what police doing, is that working or not? Our new laws that have been passed since 2012, are those working or not? All those types of analyses could be done with this data if it were more freely available on this website.
Do we know from one local police department to the next, is there a consistent standard of how they keep data? So if you wanted to, as a reporter, say, you could go jurisdiction by jurisdiction and get comparable data, or are they all doing their own thing?
They're all reporting similar data to the state, which you could go to every single one and request. The great thing and kind of the bad thing right now about the Department of Justice is that it's collecting data from hundreds of law enforcement agencies. That's the great thing, is that it means that we don't have to do that ourselves. The bad thing is that it's not currently available to us. So if we wanted to look at something, a statewide trend, it would require us to go and submit requests to hundreds of law enforcement agencies.
Is there a sense, and I imagine the answer here is yes, but a sense that looking at data from 2012 as the latest data today isn't that useful for anybody?
Well, it still gives some indicators. Mm-hmm. You know, it gives some indicators of crime levels, and we can still look at 2012 compared to, you know, decades before then. So like the rape statistics, for example, we were able to look at those numbers from 2012 and find that, you know, at last we know the number of rapes reported in the state had been rising and the crime solving of rapes had been worsening. So that gives us some indication that, you know, there might be things to be concerned about there. But we don't know if those trends have continued through today.
Well, there's local, there's state. How about the federal government? I know the FBI keeps some kind of crime statistics. Do they drill down deeply enough to where they might have more up-to-date data that we could use than the state currently is releasing?
Yes, in some ways. So the federal government will freely post online a lot of statewide statistics. What it doesn't post is a lot of things down to individual communities, particularly smaller communities. So if you live in a, you know, relatively smaller city like Wausau or Waukesha, you know, rather than like Milwaukee or Madison, the smaller cities don't always get their data posted as freely or as easily on federal websites. So that's really where the state website comes much more in handy, is if you live in a small town or a small county, you could go to the state website and find, you know, data specific to your local police department.
Now, I know you are a data kind of guy and a crime reporting kind of guy. If this thing popped up next week, this up-to-date info or what it actually does, what are you after first? What data are you excited to see come out when we have the up-to-date stuff on that website?
I would probably look at the crime-solving statistics first, mostly because it's the type of statistic that a lot of people in the community are not aware of or are not monitoring themselves. A lot of city councils are really actively monitoring crime levels, but not necessarily the other side of the coin, which is how often are we actually solving those crimes.
Right, and when you read crime reporting, it's usually crime just happened, and then in a week, it's not crime solved or not, it's the next crime that happened.
Yeah, it's, you know, crime solving can sometimes get lost in the daily chaos of life. You know, we look at what new thing happened and forget to circle back to what came of it, you know, months or years later.
Well, Keegan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to investigative reporter Keegan Kyle, looking at his research on how Wisconsin is lagging on publishing its crime data and why that data is useful to the public, to reporters, and to the police themselves. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard.
Have you ever stopped to think about whether you spend more time and money experiencing new things or getting new stuff? Do you think that you get more pleasure out of owning the latest and greatest gadget or planning and taking an amazing trip or even something like an art class?
Science is showing that if you value experiences over objects, you'll probably score higher on a satisfaction scale. And with us to explain why that is Thomas Gilovich. He's a professor of psychology at Cornell University. Thomas, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, science says that when we have to decide between a thing and an experience, we should pretty much pick the experience every single time. How come?
Well, I wouldn't say every single time. What I would say is that it's very tempting. Most of us have limited financial resources, after all, and it's very tempting to say to yourself, oh, you know, I'd really love to have that experience. I'd love to go see that band in concert. I'd love to have that vacation. I'd love to take those lessons. But, you know, those will come and go in a flash, however enjoyable they are. Maybe I should invest instead in something more substantial, furniture, clothing, an addition to the house that will last longer. And what the research suggests is that although that sounds solid, and it is true in a material sense, psychologically it's the reverse. The things that you're around all of the time, the furniture, the addition to the house, you adapt to them and eventually don't notice them, whereas the experiences that you have live on in the stories that you tell, the sense of identity that you've achieved, the way that it has helped you to grow. And so the recommendation is not to pursue the experience every single time. It's just to tilt our expenditures a little more in the experiential direction, a little less in the material direction, and then we'll be happier.
Well, it sounds as though one of the reasons this is true, research has shown, is the effect of, you know, what we might call rose-colored glasses, that we might not have had the best time if we were on a big bike trip in the rain, but looking back, we'll think, you know, that was great. I had a new experience, I challenged myself, and therefore it's better in retrospect in the rearview mirror.
Yes, that's correct, and that can sound like a distortion, and to some degree it is. We can take a bad experience and romanticize it and think it was better than it was. But in another respect, it really isn't a distortion. It's just two different perspectives on the same thing. When we're going through an experience, the details really matter, and if it's bitterly cold or if the mosquitoes are biting you, those details determine your enjoyment. At the same time that you're living through those details, you're also accumulating an experience. You're climbing over a mountain pass. You're becoming a kind of person who can endure the outdoors. And with time, with perspective, we tend to evaluate our experiences not in terms of their low-level details, but in terms of their broader meaning. So it really isn't so much or isn't always just a distortion. It's really a change of perspective in terms of what are you getting out of the experience? In the here and now, it's the details. Later on, it's the broader meaning.
And you mentioned a little bit about, you know, that getting used to things. You know, you have a new coat or even a new car, and the thrill wears off, it sounds like, maybe quicker than it would if you went on a trip and you think back on it. What's the difference there?
The one difference is that for the experiences that a person has, you tend not to adapt to them as quickly because they live on in the connections you make with other people. When you run into someone else who's seen the same performers, that's an immediate social connection, an enriching conversation that you wouldn't otherwise have. When you run into someone who's vacationed in the same place, the same thing. Now, of course, you feel a little more similar to someone who has the same material possession as you do, but not nearly to the same degree. If you and I found out that we owned the same model computer, we'd feel a little bit closer to each other than we had before, but not nearly as much as if we both learned that we hiked the John Muir Trail, let's say.
Doesn't it get into the area of unflattering comparisons, where if you went on a trip and I went on a trip, but yours was fancier, you know, am I going to feel as bad as if, say, we own the same car?
Yeah, that's a good point. Let's go back to that very same example of we both buy the same type of computer, but the more we probe it, I find out that yours is just better. It has a faster processor, the screen is brighter, and so on. How much would that buy? And you got it more cheaply than I did. How much would that bother me, or how much would that bother the average person? Quite a bit. You don't want to be outgunned on someone by someone on a standard consumer purchase. Now compare that to you find out that you vacationed in the same spot as someone else. That person was there. They had better weather. The hotel was better and cheaper. How much would that bother you? Again, it would bother you a bit, but not nearly as much, partly because you're not going to trade your memories for your experience with someone else's. And so it just doesn't have the same oomph that an unfortunate comparison on a material good does.
We're talking to Thomas Gilovich right now. He's a professor of psychology at Cornell University, and he's explaining for us why people get more satisfaction out of experiences generally than they do about over things. And another part of this is anticipation, and that can be a big part of the happiness factor. How does it work when it comes to experiences and things?
Well, we're pretty good at spending our money in ways that make us happy. So if we're anticipating an upcoming material purchase or an experiential purchase, thinking about it is going to make us happy. However, looking forward to the material good, in addition to overall producing a sense of happiness, it's tinged a little bit with this kind of impatience. It's like the kid before Christmas. You just can't wait for Christmas to get here. I want this now. And that doesn't ruin the enjoyment by any means, but it diminishes it, gives it a slightly different, less pleasant flavor. Whereas when people are looking forward to experiences, it doesn't have that same got to have it now. In fact, we often want to put off the experience because we want to enjoy the consumption of merely thinking about it. Oh, it's going to be great to be on the white sand beaches of Hawaii. And you don't want it to come right now. You want to enjoy thinking about it. So the anticipation of experiences is often more enjoyable than the anticipation of material goods. And, of course, we buy things not just for having them right then and enjoying them in the here and now, but we also enjoy things in anticipation and in the memories we have about them afterwards.
There's some interesting studies about this, too, one in which people were offered a thank you gift of a pen or potato chips. What happened there?
Yeah. In one condition of that experiment, people either ate the potato chips or drew with their Cornell pens by themselves. That is, there were no other objects around. So presumably they were evaluating the pen or the chips on their own terms. In another condition, on the table where they received their chips or pen, there was, in the chips condition, a bunch of chocolate, and Cornell students like chocolate more than potato chips, and that would lead them to think, okay, I'm getting potato chips here. Other people must be getting chocolate. Why didn't I get chocolate? And the question is, how much is that going to bother them? In the condition where they were given a pen, there were a bunch of Cornell mugs on the table, leading them to think, maybe other people got mugs. Why didn't I get a mug? And then after the experiment, they evaluated how much they liked their pen and the chips. And they didn't like the pen nearly as much when they thought other people got mugs. That, again, material possessions invite these kinds of keeping up with the Joneses psychology. How am I doing relative to other people? A pen is not as good as a mug. And you might think that at first about, hey, why didn't I get chocolate? Why do I have to eat these chips? And that might make you feel a little unhappy for a moment, but then you start eating the chips and the salt and fat on the chips taste good. You get involved in that and you forget about the comparison. Comparisons matter less when it comes to engaging experiences than when it comes to material goods.
And we leave it there. Thomas, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to do so. Thank you.
That was Thomas Gilovich, professor of psychology at Cornell University. He explained for us why people get more satisfaction out of experiences than out of things.
And now I want chips. Thanks for that. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listen to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's Food Friday time, and it's time to go with the grain. Whole grain, that is. Humans have been eating whole grains for thousands of years, and we're just recently seeing their resurgence in mainstream popularity.
Joining us now is Robin Asbell, author of The Whole Grain Promise, more than 100 recipes to jumpstart a healthier diet, which walks us through some easy ways to make whole grains a part of our everyday cooking. Robin, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, before we get to the how, can you tell us some of the why? Why should we be incorporating more whole grains into our foods?
Well, you know, whole grains are just the basis of a healthy diet. They have been for thousands of years. And whole grains, I always say they're the antidote to whatever else you're eating. They help to decrease your risk of, you know, heart disease, high blood pressure, stroke, type 2 diabetes, lower your inflammation, help stop leaky gut, prevent colon cancer, and they're full of prebiotics and antioxidants, and they help you maintain a healthy weight.
So let's walk through a little bit what we're talking about. What are some examples of the whole grains we should be using?
Well, you know, you can either go with things like just, you know, changing over to whole wheat bread, or you can get more into cooking with actual whole grains, which is, you know, millet, amaranth, quinoa, things like that.
One worry I think a lot of people have is that whole grains is going to be denser, coarser for baking for a lot of recipes, that we're going to lose some quality in the food we're eating.
Oh, no. And it's really just a matter of you know, kind of wrapping your brain around that it's just a little different, you know, and there's some tips and tricks and ways to work with that. But once you get used to it, I think a lot of it's mostly a psychological barrier.
Do you think that people have really embraced whole grains these days, or does it still sort of have that overtone of leftover hippie cuisine?
You know, just this last year, in 2015, there was a big survey done by the International Food, you know, Opinions Group. I can't remember their name, but they said that 70% of consumers are saying that they want to eat more whole grains, and that 50% eat all whole wheat bread. Well, so it's not as far out there as it may once have seemed.
Let's get into some of the tips and tricks you mentioned. And one easy way I've tried is substituting some wheat flour for white flour. It's some things I don't notice the difference. I make a pumpkin oat bread. I swap in wheat flour one for one with white flour. Great, no problem. I make apple crisp a lot. I try to put in any proportion of wheat flour, and I hate it. It's terrible. Is there a secret to baking desserts, things like that, with wheat flour instead of white flour?
Well, that's, you know, one of the tips I give in the book is, like, when you were doing that with the pumpkin bread, is you were, you know, because whole grains have a stronger flavor, a more assertive flavor, if you use other more assertive flavors with them, they balance better, you know. So you've got something in there like pumpkins and spice or chocolate or, you know, tons of cinnamon. You're not really going to notice, you know, if you make a peanut butter cake or something that's already kind of brown and very flavorful, you're not going to notice that a little bit of the flour's got a little more flavor.
I want to talk a little bit about rice, because I love rice. And then that report dropped a few years ago about arsenic being linked to the different varieties of rice, including brown rice. And now I think, can I still eat rice or can't I? What's the final verdict on this?
Well, the latest, and there's actually a, you know, a whole, I wrote a whole sidebar about this in the book, is that most of the arsenic in brown rice is in the bran layer. So white rice is perfectly safe, as are the other color rices like black and red. And the problem is that in the southern United States, like Texas and Louisiana, there is inorganic arsenic in the soil. And so that the rice draws that up and puts it in the bran layer. So if you eat rice from California or India or other parts of the world, it's much lower in arsenic. But the current estimate is to stick to adults about a cup and a half of cooked brown rice a week. And that's not that hard to do. And also, I think that's just an opportunity to try these other grains like quinoa and freca. You know, why stick to just brown rice?
And I wanted to ask about freca. I saw a recipe for it in the book. What is freca? That's one that's new to me.
Freca, I really think, is just going to keep getting hotter and hotter. What it is it looks sort of similar to bulgur most of the time. And it's green, unripe wheat that's been roasted in the hull and then husked so that it has this lovely toasty flavor. And it's higher in some nutrients because of this process of harvesting it green. And so it's really a wonderful, it's got a great flavor.
So what would we do with freca?
Well, I'd do a salad in there. You know, you can use it in your pilafs. You can just cook it up and eat it like rice. You could use it instead of bulgur in your tabbouleh. And it's just got a great, you know, like I say, it's got a little smokiness, a lot of nuttiness.
We're talking to Robin Asbell right now. She's the author of The Whole Grain Promise, more than 100 recipes to jumpstart a healthier diet. And one of the concepts that you use a lot in your book is this the concept of stealth nutrition and sneaking some of these whole grains into food. Tell us about that.
Yes, I believe in lying. No, kidding. The main thing is that we've done so many, there are so many wonderful studies about this, actually out at Dr. Brian Wansink out at Cornell does all these studies about how people, you know, their perceptions toward food are very inaccurate. And one of them is that the minute you call something healthy, people start tasting weird flavors in it, even if it's not, you know, there's nothing in there. You know, they'll tell people, well, try this, it has soy flour in it. And they immediately say, oh, it's gritty and funny tasting. And there's no soy flour in it. You know, so the idea is that it, and we're so easily fooled. And again, it's very psychological. So what I do, and I've worked for many years as a private chef cooking for families, and I've just learned that the thing to do is just put it in there. Don't say anything. If anything, call it gourmet and maybe too nice for children. And then just, and you know, because it's all an image thing. You know, is it like people are saying black rice now is hot or farro is very gourmet, whereas people think of brown rice as, you know, health food. And so just, you know, call it good food and serve it, and people will be more likely to just enjoy it.
Man, oh man, I've been doing this all wrong for my kids.
Right.
Hey, kids, let's try this new grain. It's healthy. You'll like it. And yeah, that it's they know it tastes bad before it even hits the plate.
Right. And you probably knew
yeah.
that.
Oh, yeah. They decide before it's out of the pot. What the heck is this? You know, so that's and that's the same thing with, you know, grown-ups, too. So as you were saying, there's just this idea. And if you ever had a nasty, dried up old whole wheat bread, you're going to think it's all like that. And it's really not.
Well, what is a good first step in sneaking some of these whole grains into a recipe that might otherwise, you know, not have them there? What's a good way to start?
Well, first of all, I mean, if you're going to use flours. There's two flours you need to investigate, and one is white whole wheat flour, which it's a whole wheat, which actually just has a pale bran layer, so it looks lighter. It's more sort of golden than brown, and it's a little lower in gluten, and it's a very tasty flour, so you can slip some of that in without it being so visible. And the other is that whole wheat pastry flour is better for using in, say, your cookie or your cake because it's lower gluten. It's very finely ground, so there's no little chunks or chips in there. Then you want to start out with just doing a percentage. And I covered a survey. It was an experiment done here at the University of Minnesota where they gradually increased the whole wheat flour in the buns and the pizza at a middle school over the course of a year without telling anyone. And by the end of the year, the kids were eating all whole wheat, and they had no idea, and were eating just as much.
Wow.
I've done this with pancakes at home. I got up to 50-50 before it was really noticeable, and I leveled it up. So we've got half and half whole grain white flour pancakes at home now. So, okay, I'm working with some science here. I want to get into a recipe you shared with us on the Central Time Facebook page, Robin. Hard one to say, savory streusel squash pie with oat crust. It's a tongue twister, but talk us through the recipe.
Sure. Well, you know, everybody likes pumpkin pie when it's sweet. And so this is a wonderful side dish at Thanksgiving or the holidays or any time in the winter. And so it's just I made a chunky, oaty, you know, crust with herbs and more savory flavors. And then made a beautiful, you know, savory squash filling again with lots of herbs and yumminess. And then a crumbly streusel on top. So there's lots of crunch and color, and again, the squash and lots of flavor. And so it's a really great one.
Now, is this going to please the fussy kid in us that wants everything to be, you know, as unhealthy as possible?
Well, it's, you know, more interesting than pilaf, I suppose. You know, it's kind of hitting all your, you know, you've got your vegetables, you've got your grains in there. But I find that children's palates, again, as a private chef, they're all so different. You know, there's going to be one kid who's going to go for this and another one who might go for, you know, the frika salad. It's hard to say.
Again, that pie is on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. We've got Matt with us in Menominee Falls. Matt, hi.
Hi there. I'm wondering if your guest knows anything or can tell me anything about something called TEFF. T-E-F-F?
Sure. Teff is a wonderful ancient grain. It's one of the tiniest grains. Teff actually means lost in the original language. It was once the central grain in Africa, of some parts of Africa. And the main way people eat it here is in injera bread, which you can get in Ethiopian and West African restaurants sometimes. Very nutritious.
And how do you prepare it? How do you turn teff into injera?
Well, it's ground into flour and then fermented into and cooked like a little pancake.
Huh.
So there's that. And also you can buy it whole and cook it up. It's tiny and it cooks up to sort of a little porridge with bits of crunchy grain in there. And it's just delicious. It comes in a dark brown or ivory. And it's really, really high in some trace minerals. And it's beautiful grain.
Can you buy a ready-made teff flour?
Yes, yes, you can. And actually, in my neighborhood, you can buy 50-pound bags.
Wow.
Because there are a lot of people who live there who make teff.
Well, Matt, thanks a lot for that call. I had never heard of teff before, and we're talking here with Robin Asbell, the author of The Whole Grain Promise, more than 100 recipes to jumpstart a healthier diet.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you adopted more grains, whole grains, into your diet? Do you have a favorite one you'd want to share with us, or do you have a question on how to cook with one? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our Food Friday discussion now about cooking with whole grains with Robin Asbell. She's the author of The Whole Grain Promise.
We're taking your calls. Do you like to use whole grains in your cooking, your baking? Do you have a favorite snack, meal, recipe you'd like to share? Or do you have a question about how to get more whole grains into your diet? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take a caller now. We've got Ruth joining us in Eau Claire. Ruth, hi.
Hi. I would say buckwheat is one of my favorites, especially buckwheat pancakes. And generally when I eat pancakes, I get a really heavy feeling in my stomach afterwards, and not with buckwheat. It's awesome. I love it. I love the flavor of it. And I also have a question, which is for adults who, like, no longer necessarily do sit-down meals, their family is grown and gone from home, you know, how do you suggest people, you know, I actually just had a talk with a friend today about this, you know, like, how do you get this into your diet when you're no longer doing, like, a family meal and you're eating a little bit more, just sort of here and there as you feel you need to during the day.
Right, that's a great question, Ruth. I'm glad you brought that up because there is this association with all these whole grains that they take a long time. And if you're going to spend 40 minutes cooking something on a stovetop, then you want it, you know,
you want it to be something that serves more than one person. So that's what do you think about that, Robin? How do you make these accessible for smaller portions?
Oh, sure. It's very easy, and I have instructions in the book about how to, you know, say, cook a big batch, and you can either freeze them in smaller portions. You can just make some to eat throughout the week, you know, and say, make a big pot of millet, and you can have some warmed up with milk on Monday, and then have it for lunch as a salad on Tuesday, and then, say, Thursday, you can pick up Chinese takeout and serve it over millet, you know, so you can just make these things ahead for yourself and also, you know, just make sure that you're taking care of yourself.
Ruth, thanks for that call. And that reminds me, one thing that surprised me in your book, Robin, is smoothies, working grains into your smoothies, which wouldn't have leapt to my mind.
You know, and the thing about smoothies is so often they're just, you know, fruit. They can be very sweet. And we know that whole grains have a really great satiety index, which means they keep you full. And say, I put quinoa in one because quinoa is a star of a protein and minerals. So you throw a little quinoa in your smoothie. It makes it thick and really wonderful, and you stay full longer.
Oh. Cooked quinoa?
Yes.
Raw?
Oh, yes.
Okay, good. Because that sounds, yeah, that sounds a little too crunchy otherwise.
What about oats?
Oh, yeah.
I love oats. I could eat oatmeal every day of the week and not get tired of it. What else can I do with oats besides oatmeal?
Well, you know, I've got instructions in there on how to just make overnight oat soaks, which are just, you just mix the oats with some juice or milk or whatever you'd like and put it in the refrigerator, and it'll just soak up the liquid so you don't have to cook. And you can also use oats in so many things. I've got an oat crouton in the book, where it's sort of a savory granola crouton that you make, and it's got a little, you know, herbs and spices, and you put those on salads or float them on soup. You can put oats in all kinds of desserts and cookies and bars. I mean, oats are very versatile.
And do they actually reduce cholesterol?
They do. There is a special kind of starch in there called beta-glucan, which takes cholesterol right out of your body. And it's interesting because barley is actually higher in that. So if you want to switch over to, you know, if you really want to lower your cholesterol, eat some barley.
We're getting whole grains into our diet today with Robin Asbell, author of The Whole Grain Promise. Back to our callers now with Juliet in Rice Lake. Juliet, hi.
Hi. I'm glad that you were able to take my call. You know, I was calling at the last minute. I just wanted to comment that I used to be a chef, and I am now a mother and work at a bank during the day, but I managed to work these whole grains in, as your guest was saying. They really don't take that long to cook, but in introducing them to the kids, they've made a nice side dish always in replacement, obviously, of the potatoes and noodles that most people turn to, and really the same amount of cooking time. I have learned that to get them to taste them and make them palatable for kids, I make a pilaf with sautéed peppers and onions and whatnot. And when I'm introducing it for the first time, I always try to cook it at least every 2 weeks, and they have to take 2 bites every time I cook it. And they end up, and I tell them it's good, and if it wasn't good, I wouldn't serve it to them. And people used to pay me a lot of money to make them food. So I say, you know, take 2 bites, and generally by the end of the 6-week or 8-week period, it's something that I can work into my weekly rotation, and they like it. And as your guest said, it helps keep them full. I've also done the quinoa slow cooker for breakfast, as well as millet and whatnot. I have 2 kids that can't eat oats, so I'm always looking for other grains that I can use in place of oats. And really, it's been a tried-and-true system for me. I now have kids that eat calamari. Anytime we go out, they want it as an appetizer. You know, all of these stranger foods that a lot of kids, quote, don't like.
Gotcha, Juliet. And Robin, that's maybe what I was doing wrong when my kids rejected, like, farro out of hand. I gave up. I didn't even try that experiment again. So repeated exposure, I might have better luck, it sounds like, Robin.
Just keep trying. And again, don't make an issue out of it. You know, don't make a battle. And then just keep trying different things, because I've just found, again, through much experimentation, you will find some whole grain foods that your kids and your family love. You just kind of have to stick with it.
Well, thanks a lot for that call. And I'm going to go to Heather in Eau Claire. Heather, hi.
Hi. So I'm a beginner pasta maker, and it's my understanding that gluten is necessary to make pasta. However, I have friends who would prefer to have gluten-free pasta. So are there any grains or flour that I could use to make gluten-free pasta?
Okay, great question.
You know, interestingly enough, I wrote a book called Gluten-Free Pasta, and actually you can do some whole grains in gluten-free pasta, but, you know, it's kind of complicated. You have to use other things to substitute for the gluten, but yes, you can, and you can buy a lot of dry pastas that are made from brown rice, quinoa, corn, all those kinds of things as well.
Well, thank you, Heather. Appreciate that call, and good luck with your pasta.
So, how did you first get into whole grain in the first place, Robin? What was your journey there?
You know, I was just, for some reason, when I was in high school, I had always baked bread, and there was a recipe in one of the books for whole wheat bread, and I started baking all the bread for my family, and I thought, why would anybody want white bread when whole wheat bread is so good? And I actually, my first ever job making food was my mom talked a friend of hers into selling my whole wheat bread at her little health food store. So I made whole wheat bread for her once a week.
And is that the recipe that shows up in your cookbook, or is it close to it?
Oh, gosh. I don't even remember that recipe.
Too long now.
High school was a long time ago.
Right.
All right, Robin. Robin, thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you so much. And just remember, you know, whole grains are a delicious adventure. This is all good fun.
That was Robin Asbell. Her new book is called The Whole Grain Promise, More Than 100 Recipes to Jumpstart a Healthier Diet. We've got a recipe to help you get started posted on the Central Time Facebook page. It's a savory squash pie with an oat crust. Sounds really good. I like my squash, so I think I might give that one a shot.
All right. Sounds good.
Bipartisan cooperation doesn't always happen in our state legislature, but one proposal has brought lawmakers from both sides of the aisle together to sponsor some legislation, and this is on a particularly hot issue.
The issue in question is soup. A Republican lawmaker from De Pere has proposed a bill that would designate an official state soup of Wisconsin. The contender for that soup is bouillon, the Belgian soup that's been a big part of the heritage in northeastern Wisconsin.
Comes from Belgian immigrants. It usually includes beef and chicken, sometimes pork, I read online, then vegetables, lots of them. Your carrots, rutabaga, celery, throw some potatoes in there. The good stuff is made at big events, community events, in these steel kettles, 50 gallons or more. So if you're making it at home, make sure you've got some freezer space available.
And a memo from the bill's author says the goal is to honor Wisconsin's Belgian heritage and celebrate bouillon's ability to bring Wisconsin communities together.
I'm sad to say, all my years in Wisconsin, I have never tried bouillon. I mean, it's because it's focused in the northeastern part of the state.
I have never even heard of it until we started hosting the show.
You know, working on Joy's show, like, I don't know, a lot of Joy Cardine fans love their bouillon. She always hears about that when she talks about foods from around the state. So I'm thinking we get a Central Time kettle, and I don't know how we're going to cook it here at the studio. We'll violate fire codes and make our own Central Time bouillon. Yeah, and
like
gather the community around.
Well, so send your bouillon recipes.
Put them on the Central Time Facebook page. Actually, do that thing. From a Belgian-born soup to a Belgian-born musical legend with Django Reinhardt here on Central Time.